Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
British Jay Mystery is an established music consultant and entrepreneur who has 40 years of experience within the industry. Starting his career in 1985 as a royalty clerk in the International Division for PRS, in 1994 he was approached by BMG Music Publishing Limited, where he worked in royalty tracking for 9 years. After that, he started up his own royalty tracking company, Musical Sleuth Limited, which landed him clients such as Eric Clapton, Roger Whittaker, Eddie Grant, and Daniel Bedingfield, whilst also conducting desktop audits for major publishers such as EMI, Bug, Peer, and Universal. Jay has also worked in the Discovery Channel in the role of Director of Global Music Services, as well as Jingle Punks LLC, where he was the VP of Publishing. In 2015, he started his own company, JM Music Services, where his clients range from composers to publishers, labels to tech companies and platforms. For the past 10 years, he has divided his time between consulting for various music and tech companies such as Deli Music, Zek Music, Strike Audio, and others, whilst also managing the careers of 10 composers through his management company. During lockdown, he formed his own publishing company and labeled Jam Music Publishing Limited and Jam Production Music. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Jay Mystery. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
I'm in London, in the UK, and I'm doing very well, thank you, Barrett.
So you've had an interesting world behind the scenes in the music entertainment world. So let's go back to the beginning. At what age, whether you were a child or teenager, did you feel fascinated or absorbed by the industry to think, okay, I want to step into this world?
Well, I would say that my first kind of knowledge of music probably came from my sisters, who are older than me, and they used to play the old crooners like Elvis Presley and people like David Soul and American crooners. You know, when I listened to Elvis, that was probably the first kind of moment when I thought about music in a different way. And just listening to his voice made me think about music more intently. And then I would say, you know, school, with my best friends from school, we used to listen to all different kinds of music. And I guess I was the kind of person that actually looked into the music beyond, you know, just listening to it. I kind of absorbed it and thought about the lyrics. So I would say, you know, sort of about 12, 13, 14 is when I really got into music.
What were the next steps?
Well, I was quite lucky because my brother was working for PRS, and he said there was like a summer job going at PRS, and I actually wanted to do something within the arts, but artistically. So I just had a summer job and at PRS, and I just stayed. And then I thought, actually, this is really cool because I get to see the behind the scenes stuff. So I was working in the international department at PRS, and so I was dealing with money coming from overseas for PRS composers and publishers. And it was just interesting. I was very interesting to see how much money certain songs were earning all over the world. So that was that really, I got the bug then for the administration side of things.
And for the people who are not aware, what is the function of PRS?
Oh, right. So, It's kind of a long story, but I'll try and make it as short as possible. Essentially, they're there to license pubs and clubs, radio stations, TV stations, because in order to play music and to broadcast music, you have to have a license, so that the money from the license fees goes back to the composers and the publishers who wrote the music.
Okay, interesting. And let's step into the next phase of your career after PRS.
I ended up at some one point working within the international department, but I was trying to find composers who we didn't have enough information for to try and figure out where they were or if they wrote the song or not. And it was kind of the earliest stages of royalty tracking. I was trying to find the composers to repatriate income for them. And then after that, I got a call from BMG. And BMG were one of the, that's a publishing company. They were one of the first people to do royalty tracking. And I applied for a job there. So my next step was BMG Music Publishing, doing royalty tracking.
Is the same sort of thing that you were doing at PRS?
Well, that was only a little job of mine that I did at PRS. Yeah. Okay. And I was really interested in that.
Let's dive into the next phases. So you were at BMG, and then what was the next step?
Right. So at BMG, I ended up having a team of people trying to, but we were doing royalty tracking internally. So it was mostly for BMG composers. And I was trying to make sure that they got paid correctly. So that was internally. And then I thought to myself, well, what about all the other composers and publishers, mostly in England at that time? How did they do royalty tracking? And as I said, you know, BMG, I think it was EMI and BMG were the first kind of publishers to do royalty tracking. I just thought, well, why don't I just set up my own company doing royalty tracking for everyone else? So that's what I did. And I set up my own company, and I had that for 9 years. And luckily, you know, one of my first clients was Eric Clapton. I was quite lucky because I was in a position at BMG where I knew a lot of the managers of the composers, and I just got to know them, and I got clients from them afterwards when I went out on my own. So that was pretty cool.
The artist or the composer, more than the artist, correct, would then hire you to monitor all elements of the royalty tracking around the world to see where they would be getting money in and to balance all of those elements and books out. Is that correct?
Well, yes, yeah, sort of. So it was mostly to check that they'd been paid correctly. I'd be working with four composers, but I'd be working with their publishing company or their record label.
Okay.
And I'd be going in to do essentially audits, and I'd be going into the company, or I'd be getting royalty statements from those companies, that I'd be looking at all the income to make sure that the composer had been paid correctly.
This boggles my mind. So from all the different avenues that royalty and money could come through from, was and is, well, it's different now, but was at the time all elements always, you know, box ticked or tick box that, okay, they got the money from this area, they got this money from this area, or did they ever have to like go and knock on those doors where maybe a radio station, wherever, was playing the music and they hadn't been paid to make sure that was happening?
Well, there's a sort of a hierarchy, if you like, of how income gets to the composer. Okay. So there, first of all, it would be, you know, the venue or the radio station or the TV station. They would pay PRS, and then PRS would pay the publisher, and then the publisher would pay the composer. So there are like steps. Okay. So you'd have to go back to try and find where the gaps were.
And was that easy to find, or not always?
Not always, because it was paper. When I started, a lot of it was paper-wise, and looking through contracts as well. Because if a publisher was supposed to pay, say, 85% of the income, but somebody put in 80%, then all of a sudden you'd find 5% more income for the composer. So the contracts were really important. And then you go down from like a overarching view of maybe looking at one album, and the album had 10 tracks within the album, and if you'd been paid for all 10 tracks or not, and if you had them, then, you know, you'd claim for the missing 9th or 8th track. So you did it that way, and then you'd go more granular into, did they receive sync income, performance income, mechanical, all the different sources of income. And So yeah, I gradually went down and down and down and dug deeper into their statements to make sure that everything was, you know, as it should be.
And what happens if, like, for example, artist A is singing a song that was written by other people? Is this just for the composers or for the artist who's singing as well?
Yeah, so there's two elements here. There's the composer or the composition, the song, and then there's the artist as well. And then sometimes they could be the same people, and sometimes they were completely different people. So that's what I said. I'd either go into the publishing company or the record label, depending on whether they were the artist or the composer.
So now with the changes of technology, I still love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange to say thank you to the artists for all the hard work they've done. I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, all those elementals, you know, the booklet. I'm sure being in the industry, you are aware that vinyls, CDs, cassettes are in a massive comeback. Vinyls, 5.9 million sales, the biggest since 1990. CDs as well, last year in the UK. There's a product of goods that they gauge exchanges on. And because of the spike and increase of CD sales, a product is back in the basket. And the research is showing actually that it's the teenagers that are buying into this world, not necessarily the older nostalgic people. Then we've got these streaming platforms that people consume music on. How has technology changed the way that artists are paid? We know that they don't get paid a lot in any case with streaming. But how has technology changed this whole element? And what are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
I get asked this question quite a lot. And my stock response is basically, if you are an Ed Sheeran or, you know, one of the top kind of
Dell,
this world, you're probably not complaining about your streaming royalties. And so it depends on where you are in your career as an artist, whether you think it's a good or a bad thing in terms of the amount that you get per stream. In the old days, you know, you used to have, as I said, vinyl, for example, and vinyl was, you know, say $20 or £15 or whatever it was. And you'd have to buy the whole thing. You'd have to buy the whole album to listen to every song. But now in streaming, you can listen to whichever song you want, and not necessarily the single or the one that, you know, everyone thinks is the biggest one or the best track. So that's good and it's bad, as you can see. You know, you could, like in the old phase, you'd have to buy the whole thing. And, you know, the bulk of the money went to you because of the way that the record companies worked with you and your contract as an artist with the record label. But now you've got that element, but you've also got your streaming companies who are taking a big percentage, you know, of your income. So your overall income per stream is very, very low because of all these other elements that are factored in. However, in the old days, you used to have to go to a shop and you used to have to buy, you know, you only had X amount of choice. Whereas, you know, with streaming, I could listen to some folk singer from Holland or from, you know, Indonesia or somewhere, and I would never have found those people if it wasn't for streaming or the availability through streaming. So if from a perspective of getting known, it's brilliant. You know, streaming is great because you could listen to anybody's music at any point from anywhere in the world. So is that the market is massive. But in terms of getting your returns as an artist or a composer or a publisher or a label, it's relative. That's how I would put it. It's relative to who you are and what stage of your career that you're in.
I speak to groups of people every so often who sort of enjoy music. They'll have a couple of their favorite artists. They go to a concert maybe once a year. They stream music mainly. And I've said it to a number of times, groups of 10, 15 people. I've said to them, do you know, if an artist has had 100 million streams, how much money do you think they got? And I remember the first group of people said, oh, $50 million. And the second group of people said, oh, $1 million. And I said to him, well, actually, it's like 500 or 1,000. And they were so shocked and horrified. So there definitely needs to be a learning or education piece around this, because they think that all these artists are making huges and huges amounts of money, and it's not necessarily the case. And I know for a fact that a lot of artists are, you know, except the top tier ones, are struggling, having to do other jobs to support themselves and so on and so forth. And yet the fans don't realize this. So I definitely think there needs to be, I know Snoop Dogg and Ray and a whole bunch of artists have been talking about it and highlighting that as well. What do you think it's necessary for the fans to know this, to be better educated in this, or it's okay the way it is at the moment?
No, there's definitely a need for education, definitely need it, because if you look at the, you know, the Napsters of this world, or all those sort of older stream platforms where, you know, you didn't have to pay, and or there's a lot of new platforms coming out, AI platforms, which we'll probably talk about, no doubt. There are other platforms in my particular part of the world that are giving away music for free. There's a definite need for education of, in order to sustain an artist, they need to be able to live. And that's not, you know, like a millionaire. We're talking about, say, for example, 50,000 or 100,000, whatever, dollars, pounds, whatever, a year, so they can live and make music, you know, and that's great. There are a lot of that tier of the industry that would be very happy to make money and, you know, to live and to have a nice life. So those people are the ones that are going to struggle the most, or are struggling the most, because they cannot afford to make music and, you know, pay the mortgage at the same time. So those are the people we need to look after. Because once you get over a certain amount of streams or plays or whatever, sales, yeah, then it becomes a different story. And you're not making your money from streaming. You're making your money from live, mostly. Yes. And you're making your money from merchandising.
Yeah.
And sync as well. Those three kind of areas are where you're going to really make your money. And you're more or less using Spotify and, you know, the streaming services, iTunes, as marketing rather than anything else, because a lot more people can hear your music. If you are a big hit in a small town or village or, you know, city outside of your country, it gives you a really good idea of where to go on tour, because, you know, where you look at the numbers and you're saying, oh, a lot of people are listening to our music in this particular area, that's where I need to go. So for marketing purposes and business purposes, it's a great thing.
So when you first started doing the administration side of things at PRS at the time, were you surprised how fascinated you were with the behind the scenes and admin? Did you go into that summer job at PRS thinking, okay, let's just do this? And were you surprised how excited you were about those elements?
You used to have these cards that you would write out for new music, and I'd be, you know, writing out the song, and that would be the master record for that song at PRS. And it would be for a Sting song or an Elton John song, or, you know, if we're to renew stuff, it would be a Beatles track, or it would be something, you know, very, very current. And I'd be writing out the names. And it was, you know, that doesn't sound really exciting to most people, I'm sure. But for me, I knew that that composer would get paid some money because I wrote out their name on this piece of card that went into the machine that kind of spewed out who would get what. So yeah, no, that's the bit that excited me. And so there's a little bit of like a financial thing, as in, you know, somebody was going to get paid.
Yes.
But also it was creative in terms of, you know, I knew that song and I knew that composer. There's a lot of composers that I knew at the time, because I was about 17, 18 when I started at PRS. And so I was well into my music by then. And it was very exciting for me.
And when you started your own services or consultancy, and you mentioned you had a bunch of artists like Eric Clapton, did you deal directly with him, or did you mainly deal with the record labels? Did you ever meet these people?
I met some of them, mostly I would deal with the either the accountants, or I would be dealing with the business managers or the lawyers. They would be getting me in to say, can you take a look at blah, blah, blah's yeah. royalties? And then just do me like a desktop audit. And a lot of the time they were renewing their contracts. So they just wanted to make sure that the company that they were signed to were working properly so that when they renewed the contract, it was much easier for them to say, yes, let's go with the same company.
Besides ticket sales and merch sales, when an artist performs live, are there other royalties they get at, over and above those?
Yeah, they get performance income.
So is that from the ticket sales or that's something different?
Well, that's a good question. So it's a percentage of the ticket sales that goes to the performing rights society of the country. And then that is split amongst the set list of, who is playing. And then the songs get kind of divided. The money gets divided between the songs.
And another interesting thing is I've noticed, like, for example, big artists say, Ed Sheeran or Kelly Clarkson, whomever, will cover one of their favorite Alanis Morissette songs or another artist's songs. Does that artist who they're covering the song of get royalties from that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, the composer and the publisher will, yeah.
And do they have to ask permission to perform those songs before going on tour, or is that just not necessarily the case?
No, not necessarily. They can sing whatever they like.
Now, I saw also in your bio that you also manage different composers. So what does that entail?
So, I've got 10 composers at the moment on my books. Basically, they write mostly for film and TV and advertising, so media composers. One of the two of them are artists as well, but mostly I work in the sort of music for media area or production. There is a difference. There's other production music, which they write libraries for production music companies, yep. Or we are trying to license. They do bespoke music for advertising agencies for adverts, or we get their music licensed into like films and TV programs. So it's a bit of a combination.
And then does a media client, come through to you and brief you on the project, and then it's sort of a whole bunch of people who pitch for it, and then whomever gets it. Is that correct?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. So you can work with the agencies directly. So there are various kind of agencies. So one would be like the advertising agency, the actual company.
Yeah.
But then you can have an agency that works with 10 different advertising agencies, and so you just deal with the one, but they're mostly kind of, I would say, sync agents. So those sync agents will have their connections within the media industry, and they will get briefs in. So the briefs will be, I'm trying to think of a brand that is global at the moment, like Kentucky Fried Chicken or something,
or KFC. Here we go, Coca-Cola.
Or Nike, yeah. Or Adidas or someone like that will come to them and say, look, we're making this new advert. We want music like such and such. And then the references can either be like a written reference, or it could be YouTube clips of the tracks that the director likes. So they'll say something like this, or it could just be mood and say, I want it to be dark, or I want it to be happy, or want it to be whatever. So, and in this genre, I want a happy country, track. But sometimes they go really deep, like a male vocal or female vocal. I want it this BPM. I want, no trumpets and whatever. They can make it really, really incise, or it could just be very broad. So it depends on who you're working with, what the brief is. Well, it depends also if they just want to license something. So if we've got something already, we give it to them. We put it into a little playlist and we give it to them. But if we don't have anything, and that's mostly advertising agencies where, they want something bespoke for their product. So we would write something bespoke.
Okay. And then if creative is not chosen for that specific pitch, then do you include it in your library for future opportunities?
No, that's a very good start. I don't actually have a library. I have clients who have libraries, and yes, that's what they would do. And also, like, composers will just, if they don't have, like, if they're just pitching themselves, they'll put it into their own little, you know, bank of, like, let's try and use this at some other point.
Currently, your day-to-day is composers that you're managing. Are you still doing the royalty side of things?
Yeah, no, my day-to-day is three or four things. So I have a consultancy, and my consultancy is based upon, you know, my 40 years in the business and knowledge of the industry. So it is, I work with labels still, like you said, you know, I sometimes do royalty tracking. I'm doing an audit at the moment for somebody. I work with estates where the composers passed away, and I'm working with the widows and trying to help them out. I work with libraries. I work with lots of different companies, platforms. I work with one particular platform called SphereTracks. So that's on my consultant side. Then in the middle, I would say, is all the 10 composers and the management. And on the other side, I do have my own little record label and publishing company. And I also sub-publish catalogs in the UK. So library music in the UK to try and put those into UK, local UK productions.
And your record label, is it, do you have artists signed to it?
Yeah. So it's not like a traditional label at all. This is my own kind of take on it. It's a bit of a hybrid because they are artists, and it's artists, music, that songs. And we don't like sign the artists like as in an exclusive deal. We just do song by song. So we do single song assignments where we just do track by track, and then we release those commercially and we promote it like anybody else would. We do the artwork, we upload it to Fuga and do all of that. But the main aim for us is to use all my contacts in the sync world to try and get that those tracks synced into films. So that's kind of, I'm not trying to make the artist, you know, the next big thing. That's not what I'm doing.
You mentioned Fuga. What's Fuga?
Fuga is like DistroKid. They're like a distributor.
Okay, yes. Okay. The disco. Yeah, yes. Okay. Yeah. So being part of the industry for a number of years and having your touch points in so many different types of music and genres, I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 5 minutes, 10 years, 2 hours, I know your answer will be different every time. And I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to 5 artists once we finish this conversation, but who would those artists be? And if you can think of those songs, what would the songs be?
You've interviewed one of my favorite bands, Big Country.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, definitely artistically, they would be in my top artists. But I kind of like, you're absolutely right. And I am stalling you as well. Yeah, absolutely right. It's pretty difficult, but I know it does change from sort of time to time. But I would say that like the top would be U2, probably would be my favorite band. And I do like that Celtic kind of sound. So it'd be Big Country, Simple Minds, U2, you know, all that Celtic stuff. But, you know, if you went over to individual artists, it would Elvis would definitely be up there. Female, probably Karen Carpenter or Barbra Streisand.
Yeah.
You know, they just, to me, they've got the most pure voices ever. But then, you know, like more recently, I've been listening to Ray. Ray is just phenomenal. A young lady called Lil Sims, I don't know if she's on your radar.
Beautiful,
she's just, like, lyrically, everything about her music, everything is just so good. She's been around for about, I would say, about 10 years, but she still sounds fresh to me.
Yeah. Jay, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Well, I would just say to any budding artists, keep going. And I know it's difficult. I know it's difficult to try and make a career out of this. Ultimately, it's like any business, like the cream will rise to the top. So if you're good at what you do and you're very good at what you do, you will succeed. And so just keep going
and have a good support network around you of either people that will, you know, support you financially, like parents or whatever, but also people that will support you in terms of just helping you out, maybe getting you gigs or maybe getting you, you know, your first guitar or whatever, you know, just, you can do it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.